before I do that, I better give the ID and say this is broadcast number 595, and it is May the 2nd. I can't get over that, 1983. And it is KAZU-FM, Pacific Grove, California. I didn't put that on the tape. This is side two of the broadcast, so I had to repeat that for the broadcast. Volume 18 of the Warren Commission hearings is a very good one for the formation of the Young Americans for Freedom. And in that volume, they have a list of the early members. It was formed in October 1960 at the home of William Buckley. And the founding members are in that volume. And it is important to read those names because this group were the people that linked to William Buckley of the Central Intelligence Agency and Douglas Caddy, who was at Mullen Associates in Washington, D.C., where the Watergate burglars were hired from with E. Howard Hunt. And again, the anti-Castro Cubans, going down to that group that I just mentioned on the first half of the program. Well, some of the early members, the board of directors, are founding members of the Young Americans for Freedom listed in that book. One of them is Strom Thurmond, who later works with Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple, and Jack Anderson has had many articles about his receiving payments from them. And Strom Thurmond was the man who led the crusade, the Holy Crusade, to get John Lennon out of this country. Another person on that founding group was Colonel Charles Willoughby, that famous Nazi, Kurt Weidenbach, that I mention every week, who came from Asia and was close to Robert Morris and William and Buckley, and it had his name on there. Another one was Senator John Tower. When Marina Oswald from Minsk, Russia, wanted to come in with her new husband from Navy Intelligence, the papers for her were cleared through the offices of Senator John Tower. And as I say, it's his brother-in-law who runs the weapons supplying operation for this Odessa drug-running narcotic group from the CIA with offices in Monte Carlo and he's also offices in London and elsewhere. Ronald Reagan was one of the people on this group, the founders of the Young Americans for Freedom. And Mr. Noland, William Noland of China Lobby, was part of this group. The group has a lot of military people and congressmen and even people like Igor Cassini. Very political, far right-wing group. But many of those names link up later, not so much later because it was formed in 1960. They link up to the assassination of John Kennedy and the cover-up of John Kennedy. Naturally, none of them are holding the gun, but they all link to the operation that was capable of killing heads of states all over the world, starting in Iran or then continuing with the Dominican Republic and Guatemala and John Kennedy and then the coup in Brazil. These people stayed together, a lot of them, through the years and are in power today. And the main one who's in power is Ronald Reagan. And next week I want to read, you know, his early links going back to 1963 to this group and how joyous they were that by 1980 they finally, after all their struggles, had their man in office. But I also want to discuss, because the Hitler diaries in the news now, and Hitler is one of my favorite subjects. I'm not going to do too much on Kennedy tonight. In fact, I may not do more. I do want to spend time on information coming in about the Hitler diaries, because many of you know, and I've referred to that article in the San Jose Mercury last March 28, 1982, the cover of the magazine section, Cal Day. It says, Hitler is alive, and it quotes Mae Bressel and her opinions about Adolf Hitler. And then I've read the other parts. The federal government killed John Lennon, Ronald Reagan as a front man for the forces of evil. That was the front page of a magazine section of the San Jose Mercury, if you could believe it or not. Well, what is the basis for my saying he was alive? Many times I've repeated this, and there's a lot of new listeners, and I'd have no reason to say it. I started studying the Nazi connections to John Kennedy as soon as I opened the testimony of George de Morenschild in Volume 9 of the hearings, and I read backwards or in the middle. I start with Volume 9 and then went to Volume 1. There was an article in Time magazine, May 7th, 1945, on page 70 about the possibility of Hitler's double being burned and that Hitler escaped. And Henry Luce had that in Time magazine. If you want to look that up in the library, I have a copy of that Time, an original copy of that going way back. Then there's a book, UFO Nazi Secret Weapons, and it refers to the Time magazine. And that is a book with a large section. Of course, it's about Antarctica that I talk about so often. And it has the reference to Hitler and the possibility that he escaped. The National Police Gazette that I mentioned, January 1977, that I have copies and can duplicate for you, 50 pages on the escape route of Adolf Hitler. Now, there are many articles in history books about what happened to Hitler, just as there are about what happened to the Romanov family when the Russian Revolution came. But I personally had contact with three sources specifically that gave me the idea that I should pursue it further. And one was from a man who had been in Argentina. He didn't say he worked for the CIA. He lives, his home base is Monterey Peninsula. I know his family. I was at a party where members of the family were. And the subject, I don't know how it came up about Nazis at the time. It was about 4 or 5 years ago. And the subject of Adolf Hitler came up, and he said that it was common knowledge in Argentina, where he was, of Hitler's survival. And he wasn't shocked at all. He offered, you know, to talk about it. Then the second source was a woman who lives in Los Angeles, who I see now. These aren't just anonymous phone calls I get, and I work on hunches. She is, originally, she was from the Honduras, and then for a while, she lived in Brazil. She married a German man. He lives in the Midwest now. They're still married, but live separately. And she was in Brazil at April 20th, 1968, at the anniversary of Hitler's birthday, when Gustav Franz Wagner, W-A-G-N-E-R, was at that birthday party with the top Nazis from Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina. They have a party every year in the German colony. And Wagner was caught in a photograph at this party, and he was seen with Hitler. And this person told me that down in Brazil, there was a lot of newspaper articles. A diligent researcher, I've never been able to have the time, or I never thought about it, looking up in the Brazil newspapers what happened the week of April 20th, 1968. She said there were many articles in the newspaper about Hitler and that he was at this party. And that was just passed over. The World Press, the Associated Press, United Press didn't pick it up at all. But Mr. Wagner went into hiding. I have some stories, one from the Washington Post, June 22nd, 1979, how he went to the police and asked them to protect him from May 1978, because he was named in the newspaper as one of the Nazis attending the neo-Nazi Congress held to celebrate the birthday of Adolf Hitler. This is Washington Post, June 22nd, 1979, and it tells about his activities there and how he asked the police to protect him. And then October 4th, 1980, there's a story, ex-Nazi officer commits suicide. He was so distraught, again, like our stories that I read before, all these various people that happened to be offed. This poor Wagner, it's like Duberstein, he's, all of a sudden he commits suicide in the custody of the police. And this story said that there was a newspaper photograph taken at a birthday anniversary party for Hitler near Rio de Janeiro. And this woman lived in Brazil at the time. And then the third person was a man from Amsterdam who was at my home and saw the library of the Nazi books. And he lived with the son of Alfred Rischer, R-I-T-S-C-H-E-R. And Rischer was the man who scouted the Antarctic area for Hitler in 1938 and 39 in case they needed a place to go. And he traveled with him down to Antarctica in 1945 in the boats. They flew out of Germany and then took the boats down to Argentina and Antarctica. So those were my three sources. And with that in mind, I look at history and say, well, maybe or maybe not. But I think a person has to ask questions, and it's very important the right questions aren't asked. And as a result, the newspaper people and the authorities are all in a going around in a circle about the Hitler's diary. Didn't he write them or didn't he write them? And the important thing in my mind that I want to share with you now isn't, has he authored them or has he authored half of them, or did he see any of it or he didn't see any of it, but the story of how they were procured, which is much more interesting to me. We can get to who wrote them later, but how they were procured is the most interesting part. Incidentally, when I left here last Monday night after the broadcast, I went over to the Monterey Institute of Foreign Studies because Eugene Ionesco, I-O-N-E-S-C-O, was there. He's from France. He wrote The Rhinoceros and The Bald Soprano and other plays, and he's one of my heroes. I love Ionesco's plays. He introduced me to what they call the theater of the absurd. But one of the things that he said that was quoted in the Monterey Herald, he was asked a question which he said he couldn't answer. Just because you write a play doesn't assume that you know all the answers. But Ionesco poses questions. This is what it said in the Monterey Herald in his plays. He does not answer them. And he concluded his speech that evening by saying, we have to live these questions in order to be alive. You have to ask questions in order to be alive. You can't accept everything that you are told or you will die. And to stay alive, you have to ask the questions. You may not know the answers. So go along with the questions about Adolf Hitler and his life, there are a lot of stories that have been concealed about the whole era. In fact, I read last week, I think it was in the New York Times, that 100 million papers on World War II are still locked up as top secret. 100 million. Can you believe that? Goodness knows where they're keeping them. Well, the story that was of interest to me, the first story and the longest and the best, is from the London Times, April 24th, last Sunday. The fellow who went after the diaries is Gert Heidemann, H-E-I-D-E-M-A-N-N, 51 years old, a journalist. He was brought up in Germany. He grew up in Nazi Germany as a child. He's had a hobby of Nazi memorabilia. He collects everything. Everything Nazi, he loves it. He raised, according to these stories, £40,000, which is $200,000 in 1973, to buy Field Marshal Hermann Goering's yacht. Now, how did he raise it? Did he get it from Otto Skorzeny? Where did he get it? Who put up the money? That's a question I'd like to know. As soon as he had the yacht, former ex-Nazis began coming to the yacht. The yacht was used, incidentally, by the King and Queen of England, by Queen Julianne of the Netherlands with her Nazi husband, Prince Bernhard, by King Baudouin of the Belgians, B-A-U-D-O-U-I-E-N, who betrayed the Belgians and was knighted by the Vatican, the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. It was used by Konrad Adenauer, and from 1945 until the British returned it to Hermann Goering's widow, Emmy, and then she sold it, and then Heidemann took it over. As soon as he had this yacht, he began to see top Nazis. SS General Karl Wolf, and Karl Wolf is the gentleman written up in those books on the Operation Sunrise. He secretly negotiated the surrender of all the Third Reich forces in South Germany to America. And he was working with Alan Dulles and Mr. Himmler, and SS General Karl Wolf worked in Milan with Walter Rauff, R-A-U-F-F, the head Nazi, the companion of Klaus Barbie, who helped Mr. Pinochet when the CIA put Pinochet in office and killed Salvador Allende. SS Brigadier Fuhrer Wilhelm Mohnke, M-O-H-N-K-E, came to visit him on the yacht. He was the last commander of the Berlin bunker. And a General Hans Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, wrote a book. And it was Mr. Brigadier General Mohnke who told him that there was this aircraft that disappeared that Hitler had sent out, and that some possessions belonged to Hitler were not with the other material that sent out. One plane had crashed. So October 15th, 1980, Mr. Heidemann starts out to inquire where this material was. It was written up in a book, but nobody took it seriously for a long time and didn't go after the diaries. But Mr. Heidemann went to the Wehrmacht Information Bureau, that's the German Army Information Bureau, for the details of Germans killed in action. Now, these men weren't killed in action. A plane went down. There were no soldiers or any fighting involved, but they had a record of a plane that crashed 38 years ago, April 21st, 1945. So that he decides to look up the circumstances. He gets the name of the town, and this Mr. Heidemann is on his way. Now, what was flown out of there that he was searching? This is the story from the London Times. Adolf Hitler's birthday, again, April 20th, this is years earlier, 1945. Martin Borman's at the birthday party, and they have what they call an Operation Seraglio, S-E-R-A-G-L-I-O. Pretty Spanish sounding now. They're getting out of Germany. And they decided at Hitler's birthday, let's put the operation in action. And Martin Borman's a great man. You know, the diaries say Hitler wanted five Bormans, but Borman made arrangements. He's transferring the Nazi headquarters to Hitler's home in Berchtesgaden. The day after the Fuhrer squadron is to leave, there are 10 planes that go out. Four go one evening. Plane three and four aren't described at all. But the Fuhrer squadron is ready to go, and Major Gundelfinger was a part of it. G-U-N-D-L-E-F-I-N-D-E-R. Finder, he is the one who is killed. Now, Borman arranges to take the Reich files and the records for the Third Reich, R-E-I-C-H, out of Berlin. Hermann Goering is in the bunker. Mr. Himmler's in the bunker. They also leave April the 20th. And a General Ferdinand Schroener, S-E-H-R-O-E-N-E-R, plans to remain to the end. He says he'll die in the bunker. It wasn't clear if Hitler would leave or not, but Borman wanted Hitler's escape. And in anticipation that the Fuhrer would leave, his possessions were to be packed up and shipped out. 10 aircraft at that date were already dispatched from Berlin. And then one person, Mr. General Hans Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, he never was on the yacht. He never shows up at the yacht. He was put in a prison in the Soviet Union and got out, and he wrote a book about this later in 1956 called The Missing Plane and Important Papers. He had disappeared. He didn't get to South America. He was picked up by the Soviets because he was important to Hitler. He was one of the important people to the Hitler Air Force Squadron. And the Soviets kept him for a while, and buried in his book was the information or the implication of these diaries. Now, Operation Seraglio was a high-secret plan. As I say, Hitler had 10 aircraft dispatched, and one of them, just one, disappears. 9 went off, but the description of the London Times of what Hitler had in the bunker that they were packing up. Hitler's bedroom in the bunker, there's a small steel safe, 4 feet high, 3 feet wide, stuffed to the brim with Hitler's personal papers, files, and letters. There was another file 2 and 3, 2 more, in Hitler's bedroom. They were not big enough for everything he had. He had some on the first floor of the Reich Chancellery. He had another safe at number 16 in his private flat in Munich that they had to clear out, and another safe, a steel locker at the Berchtesgaden home up in the hills there that they had to get out. Martin Borman was to arrange all that. Now, Mr. von Braun and Mr. Dornberger and the Punemann scientists and Mr. Borman had been planning for 2 years the escape, it's interesting that all this valuable stuff is collected for 10 planes to get out at this particular time. They've got 10 more days before it's all over, and this is on the 20th. Now, in this list, among the list of possessions, according to a man who was there, in the safes, Hitler had hidden, this is what he says, the membership list of the Nazi Party going back to its earliest days, as well as lists of the foreign contributions to the Nazi Party and Hitler's supporters abroad. Do you need anything more when you're going out? Borman has taken all the art and gold out of the continent of Europe. They've taken all the paintings off the walls and shipped them out. They've counterfeited money for a year and a half. They have exited every bank. Every bit of cash in the German banks is out. And Der Fuhrer is sitting with the list of those people to put them in the first place. And 10 plane loads are leaving, and the safes are going to be emptied. And just one plane crashes and burns. But by some miracle, we're supposed to believe that the Fuhrer's diaries are taken by a Wehrmacht officer who doesn't call up the office and say, Der Fuhrer, here's the sealed swastika and the Nazi emblems, your seal, with letters of Borman and Fuhrer and Rudolf Hess. And Hess at this point is in prison over in England. He's locked up. A Wehrmacht officer is going to call the headquarters and say, look what I got out of the fire. He would have been promoted. That's a good story. No, but he didn't do that. But the planes leave, and interestingly enough, there was one survivor. And when Mr. Heidemann goes looking for this person, he goes to the town where the plane crashed. He locates the town. He goes to the cemetery. There's 16 German servicemen neatly buried there. One grave says Wilhelm Arndt, A-R-N-D-T. That's Hitler's valet who's carrying these 60 volumes, his precious valet. And Friedrich Goldfinger, G-U-N-D-L-F-I-N-G-E-R, the pilot, he's dead. And then there's a name, Max Phoebes, F-I-E-B-E-S, who's buried there. He's one of Hitler's bodyguard. Well, Mr. Heidemann goes to the record and contacts Leni Phoebes, the widow of one of the men who died. He was a member of the SS. And she gives him the name of one of the rear gunners on the plane, Franz Westermeier, W-E-S-T-E-R-M-E-I-E-R. And he lives in The Hague in Upper Bavaria, and he survived the crash. So this fellow who owns Goering's yacht, who's with Mr. Wolf, SS Carl Wolf, the right-hand man of Klaus Barbie, they take trips together to South America to see Barbie, and we'll do more of that next week. The plane is crashed, the pilot's dead, Hitler's valet is dead, but there's a survivor, Franz Westermeier, and he survives the crash. Now, Mr. Westermeier, this is interesting, in 1953, according to this story, wanted a job. He's a survivor of the Hitler personal possessions, the most loyal troop, the inner entourage of Adolf Hitler with Martin Bormann and Himmler all up there till the last hour. He miraculously survives his plane crash, and in 1953, the Germans open their newly formed airline, the Lufthansa, L-U-F-T-H-A-N-S-A. That's going very nicely now. And Hitler's top, one of his top people from the very last days in the bunker, applies for a job at the newly formed airline, the Lufthansa. He survived this crash. Okay. And when he goes there for the job, who is the man who takes the applications for the new German airline? It's Oberlieutenant, the German, O-B-E-R-L-E-U-T-E-N-A-N-T, Schultz, S-C-H-U-L-T-Z. Mr. Schultz is the pilot of the second plane. There were four that went out that night, and one was crashed. He's the pilot of the second plane who was very important to Adolf Hitler also. Now, when 1953 rolls along, he is hiring for Lufthansa Airline. Now, if you want to know how Joseph Mengele's or Klaus Barbie or Martin Bormann get in and out of Europe, the stewardesses, can you imagine the pilots he hires, the stewardesses he hires, the truckloads of material that are loaded on planes, the Lufthansa that goes in and out the United States and all over the world? I have to look up the routes now. The Lufthansa, a man who did the hiring when it was newly formed, was one of the four pilots that carried the most precious treasures of Adolf Hitler out of the bunker, and a survivor from the plane that blew up is meeting him now to work at the Lufthansa. Now, in April 1980, when Mr. Heidemann locates these people, all of a sudden Mr. Westermeier dies of cancer. I don't know whether it was a long cancer or whether it was a three-week cancer like Jack Ruby, or like a shot in the behind and a lingering cancer like Martha Mitchell, where you know she'll die shortly. He dies when the track begins to close in. He just about dies, so Mr. Heidemann doesn't get to see him. But the Lufthansa implications for what you could do for the Odessa, for these people flying in and out, is just horrendous. Now, in his quest for information about the diaries that allegedly were found by the Wehrmacht, this Mr. Heidemann goes to Switzerland, where this is where I was told that Adolf went after he left the birthday party and was recognized that he was in Switzerland. This may be true, but it may not be true, but it certainly is worth asking the question. It reminds me, I brought in just part of a poem by Carl Sandburg that is apropos in The People. Yes, he has a lot of questions about politicians and what kinds of liars they are. He says, who knows the answers, the cold, inviolable truth? And when have the paid and professional liars done none else than bring wrath and fire and wreck and doom? And how few they are who search and hesitate and say, I stand in a whirlpool and tell you I don't know. Yet I have worked out this guess for myself, Sandberg said, as nobody's yes man. And when it happens that I no longer own the priceless little piece of territory under my own hat, so far gone that I can't even do my own guessing for myself, I will know I am one of the unburied dead, one of the moving, walking, stalking, talking, unburied dead. I bring this up because this is the kind of thing that UNESCO talks about publicly and in his speeches, and it's very important, asking the questions. Well, Mr. Heinemann, as I say, goes with S.S. Wolf down to see Claus Barbie on the excuse for the diary. He's going to see Claus Barbie for the diary. He would know where the diaries are of Adolf Hitler or what happened to that plane. Now, the cast of characters that I've given you this evening are the interesting thing to me. We'll do more on the diary for a long, long time. They're going to continue it for 30 consecutive weeks. But one of the most interesting parts is the consternation of the historians. They brought in Count Dracula, that Trevor Roper, who immediately identified this as, yes, this is authentic diary. If any man was brought in to make you question the authenticity, it would be bringing in you, Trevor Roper. He was sent by Winston Churchill to identify the remains or the causes of death of Hitler at the end, and he wrote his famous book on the death of Adolf Hitler. And it turned out that after he wrote it and it became the, in quotes, authentic, the bunker wasn't even open for 5 or 6 months afterwards. And Stalin was quoted as saying not he didn't believe it, and Churchill didn't believe it, and many historians have not believed that story. But you have a yacht here owned by Goering that is given back, literally given. This man didn't sell bestseller books or goodness knows what. And then the clue is to meet on that yacht with all the top Nazis, and then on the pretext of looking for the plane, or maybe that's what they were doing, but I think the story is bigger. He is with SS Wolf and all of Hitler's top agents, and then he's traveling all over the world. Now, he collected Nazi memorabilia. He collected people. He collected top Nazis. As a matter of fact, in New Times magazine, I just have 1 minute, February 1983, it tells about Walter Rauf from the SS, who was living in South America and working with Pinochet in Chile. And it tells about his working with Mr. Wolf. His job was with Wolf in Milan, Italy, the very city that I was talking about, the gun running and the Nazis and Odessa, the first part of the program. He was part of the Supreme SS and Police Führer in Italy was Karl Wolf. And Mr. Rauf was assigned to him in Milan, and they worked together with the OSS and then the CIA. And then years later, they're on this same yacht going down to South America where Rauf and Claus Barbie are, and Mr. Wolf and Mr. Heidemann. Mr. Heidemann right now, to me, is more interesting than who wrote it, and we'll do a little bit more each week on who wrote it and get back to the John Kennedy story to keep more on that going each week. Meantime, our time is up, so we have to give up the room and the mic at this moment. This is Mae Bressel at KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.